to get to order, and let's see, today we have two or three bills that were scheduled for a public hearing and possible work session, and I guess we're going to start off with the first bill, unless, let me ask our trusted administrator if there's anything that we need to cover before we start our public hearings.
Nope, we can go right into it.
All right, then we'll go ahead and start a public hearing on Senate Bill 35, and we will call up Mr. Edwards.
You want me to give my...
Well, he can come up and listen to us all.
Okay.
And Anna, if you will tell us your thing,
you.
We'll be on schedule here.
Senate Bill 35 expands the authority of the Employment Department to issue a warrant for collection of money due to the department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Rob Edwards. I'm with the Employment Department. I'm the manager of the central operations for the tax section. And Senate Bill 35 is fairly straightforward. What we're asking for is to expand our warrant authority so that we're able to issue a distraint warrant, which is a means of collecting money due without having to go to court on judgments that we've obtained when we've been to court already. The situation where this occurs is we have subpoena power, and we also have the power to request deposits from employers. If they fail to comply with those requests, we can go to court for show cause. That sometimes leads to attorney's fees and court costs. When we then obtain the judgment, those amounts are included, but in order to collect them, we have to go back to the Department of Justice to obtain a writ of garnishment, excuse me, or whatever method we want to use to collect it. So this is basically a shortcut so we can use the warrant authority that we already have to collect those additional amounts.
Mr. Edwards, can you just walk us through, give us an example? I know you kind of breezed through how the procedure would work, but maybe put in, without identifying any particular company, just an example for us as a committee would understand how this would actually be utilized.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. If we have a company who's undergone an audit and has failed to provide us with the records that we need to complete the audit, we currently have the power to issue a subpoena. If the company fails then to answer the subpoena, we can ask Department of Justice to take the case to court as a show cause case, which is basically go to court and show cause why you shouldn't be held in contempt for failing to file the subpoena or failing to answer the subpoena.
Yes, sir. Mr. Edwards, just so we can understand, so you as the Department of the Employment Department, if you needed to have the assistance, you'd go to your attorneys who are actually employed by the Department of Justice.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Whoever's assigned to you would take this case. They would file the necessary paperwork with the court. The court, in turn, would basically require this company or individual to come forward to basically show cause why they should be, I guess one would say, held in contempt or held in, let's say, not in compliance with whatever their requirement is?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Actually, they would show cause why they shouldn't be held in contempt.
Okay.
If they provide the records, then the case is closed, but we've incurred some costs at that point. We're charged by the Department of Justice on a per-hour basis for their attorney time. There's also costs associated with the court costs, filing fees, and things of that sort. So there are some costs associated with that. And in the last 2 years or so, on advice from our attorneys, we have been asking the court where this matter is being held to include those costs in our judgment, the theory being that if the employer or their representative had complied in the first place, we wouldn't have had to incur the necessary costs to obtain the information.
All right. And any other...
I should mention that the other kind of most common situation where we'd be doing this is we also have the authority under current law to ask for a deposit from an employer. If we have an employer who our experience with them has been that they might not be of good risk as far as paying their unemployment insurance taxes, we can say, okay, we want a deposit on file for equal to the tax on the payroll of the last three quarters. Again, if they refuse to supply that deposit, we go through the show cause process, and again, that can incur attorneys and legal costs.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Beyer.
Chair, sure. Do you currently, if you have, you know, uncollectibles for a while, what's your process? Are you turning them over to the Department of Revenue then to get them collected? If this process isn't working, or are you using the private collection agencies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer. These are fairly recent enough that we haven't had that experience where we've got to the point where we've said, okay, we've been unable to collect it. What do we do with this next? My opinion is that we would probably send it to a private collection agency for collections.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
You bet.
Thank you. I'm just curious, you know, it's in the summary of the bill, and I apologize, I didn't look up the new statutory reference that was put in 667-396 to see what that pertains to. So I was just kind of, what else? Is there other things you collect money on besides the UI and then the thing you just described?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the two big things that we collect right now are, of course, unemployment insurance taxes and also unemployment benefit overpayments. And those two particular categories we already have a warrant authority for. The other item, the big item that we were looking at, are these legal costs. There is one other area in doing research on this bill where we think we might have a type of debt that's due to us is under the Federal Trade Act. We're able to purchase tools and equipment for people who are being trained, and if they fail to complete that training program, they have to reimburse us for those tools and equipment. And I don't believe that happens very often, but in theory, we could then issue a distraint warrant to try and collect those funds from those individuals. But again, I think that's fairly rare, and I doubt we'd be using it for that purpose. I'm not sure that answered your question, sir.
Any other questions from the committee? Mr. Edwards, thank you very much for your testimony. There's no one else that's signed up on the registration as a witness, but is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on Senate Bill 35? Not seeing any. And I think my chair's intention is to go ahead and move into a work session unless someone wants to hold this over. And not seeing any of that, close the public hearing and go into a work session on Senate Bill 35.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 35 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
We have a motion from Senator Beyer to move Senate Bill 35 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Not hearing or seeing any. All those in... is there anyone in objection? Let me just ask it that way. Doesn't seem to be anyone, so we'll go ahead and pass this bill to the floor unanimously with a due pass recommendation. So Senate Bill 35 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And at this time, we'll go ahead and open up a... we should probably have a carrier. Anyone want to volunteer? Mr. Senator Ringo, we did give you one if you didn't...
thank you.
Already. From, I guess tomorrow, you and I will be carrying bills that I think Senator Beyer and Senator Burdick were scheduled to carry, but I believe you all are not
available. No, Senator Whitsett.
Senator Whitsett, I believe, will be absent, so I will carry the bill.
Okay. So does anyone want to take this one, or should the chair take this
I'm
one?
I'm carrying it.
Okay. Senator Beyer will be the carrier on 35. And we'll go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 37. And Mr. Edwards, I guess you're going to be with us this afternoon, so please come back.
Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Rob Edwards from the Employment Department, Central Operations Manager for the Tax Section. Senate Bill 37 is our attempt to try and work on a problem that we recognize in trying to collect unemployment insurance taxes. We have a situation from time to time where a corporation or limited liability company will close, owing us sometimes substantial amounts of tax, and reopen relatively quickly, sometimes the next day in the same location, same equipment, same owners, officers, slightly different name. This is commonly referred to as dumping the debt of the corporation. What we would like to do with this bill is create a provision for a successorship liability, where if we have that situation where we've determined that it's basically the same employing entity reopening, that we're able to transfer the debt to that new entity. The mechanics of the bill actually allows us two different ways to do that. The first is through, we already have in place in statute a process for determining successorship tax rates. That is, if an employing unit succeeds an employing unit, they inherit their tax rate and their tax experience, whether it be good or bad. As you may probably already be aware, employers' tax rates are based on their unemployment experience. That is, the more costs they cause to the UI trust fund, then the higher their corresponding tax rate. So already in law, we have the ability to do the successorship determination for tax rates. What we're saying is, if it works for tax rates, then it probably should work for liability too. If they're a successor for the tax rate, then they're also a successor for the debt. The other avenue that we put in the bill is we would make a determination based on the factors that you see in the bill in Section 2, Sub 2. And it talks about operating from the same physical location, providing the same services, has one or more of the same corporate officers or owners. Put a little bit of a, we hope, what's protection for employers in the bill by having hearings provision. If an employer disagrees with our determination or our assessment, they can appeal it to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and an administrative law judge will make the final decision. We think that this is a good idea, mainly not so much from a dollar standpoint, because at this point it's very difficult to estimate how much money we might actually be able to collect using these, but we think it's very important from an equity standpoint. We have heard from employers who say, it's very difficult for me to compete in a particular setting because my competitors don't have to pay their unemployment insurance taxes because they keep closing and opening new businesses in the same spot with a slightly different name. And we sympathize with employers having to carry that full burden and would like to make sure that we spread it out to everyone who really deserves to pay it.
All right. Before we take questions and before I get any more trouble from my administrator, I did not give her an opportunity to make any opening comments on the bill.
Right, but
so I just want to make sure I'm not going to be living this down for who knows how long.
I do want to mention one thing, if I can. We did get a fiscal statement on this late today, and it does have what they call an indeterminate effect. And that means they can't really tell if it's going to... They thought maybe it would generate some revenue, but then they looked at it some more and decided maybe it would cost us some money down the road if we had to add staff to process these. So it was considered indeterminate.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
The rules have fluctuated a little bit on this. Do you know if that kind of a ruling means it has to go to Ways and Means, or is
nobody had mentioned that, so I'm not sure. I can look into that.
I honestly don't know the answer to that.
No, I don't either. I know that we talked about some different things.
In the past, it was if it was interim fiscal, then it didn't need to go to Ways and Means.
Okay. No. I'll check that out.
Definitely should hit that magic threshold, whatever, 50,000 that we seem to rely on in the past, which I know is not necessarily a true measure these days. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's fine. I'll take it. Everything I can get today. I deserve it. She owes you for that, I know.
Thank you.
I'm curious about some of the language, specifically in Section 2 of the bill. You use substantially the same employing enterprise, and then you list out some, in Section Sub 2, you list out some other things. But I know that the Construction Contractors Board has a statute that allows them to, I don't remember, it's the same kind of a thing, a successor business. Is this... And is substantially the same employing enterprise defined somewhere? It will be the same in the two different applications of statute?
Senator Beyer, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'm not familiar with the Construction Contractor Board statute that you're referring to. Employing enterprise for UI tax purposes is anyone who has employees. So it's a fairly broad definition. I certainly would not want to be in conflict with anything that Construction Contractor Board may be doing. We would need to go back and take a look at what their statute says exactly before I can answer that.
Can you follow, Mr. Chair?
You bet.
Thank you. It seems like this is very broad, and sub 2 seems to make it even broader when you list three things, and but it says include but don't limit it, not limited to. So, give me some examples, I guess, and sub C specifically has one or more of the same corporate directors or officers, owners. So if you've got a company A closes down and it has three partners, moves across the street, opens up a similar business, one of the partners is part of this new business and two are not, is that going to trigger
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't believe so. What we're looking for here, again, is substantially the same business. Partners come and go, but generally when we're dealing with these cases, it is usually one or two people involved at the top. Sometimes it's a corporation owned by a husband with a wife as the president or secretary. Limited liability companies, usually there's one or two members that we're talking about here. I would say that if we had a three-member partnership, for example, and two of the partners were not present in the new company, I would be hard put to argue that it was the same employing enterprise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd just like to ask that someone would go, because we did this in 2001, mm-hmm. the construction contractors board, and it wasn't dealing with for UI taxes or for it, but it was for mostly liens, because contractors would be, for bonding purposes, right. They'd get liens filed against them, they'd shut down the business, they'd reopen a business, specifically a lot of times limited liability companies. And I know we went through this. I think we ought to take a look at that language that was used in that, and maybe get a hold of whoever it is that runs the construction contracting board now, and ask them for input on this to see if it's working, if it's usable, how it works. Because we don't want people jumping across the street or just changing names to avoid paying UI taxes. But at the same time, I don't think we need to be, if you got, because the way I read this, if one or more the same, a partnership with three or four people closes down and legitimately closes down, goes bankrupt. One of the partners goes out and starts a new business, but he's, close to the same location, mm-hmm. in the same business. The way I read this, you could go after it because this is one or more.
Right. Well, it sounds like we need to get some clarification. I assume Anna will be working on that, and maybe Mr. Edwards, if he could also help facilitate some of that information so we can get this back.
Sure.
Senator Wissett.
Senator Brzezinski, Mr. Edwards, you see approximately $5 million in taxes written off as uncollectible, and that by passing this measure, you'd be able to collect 5%. I wonder what methods have you used to try to collect them in the past, and why would you only be able to collect 5% if in fact you were able to assess those charges against a new business?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, the methods that we use to collect, we have a process, a whole range of methods. We have in-house staff that are revenue agents that are trained to collect the money. We also refer accounts that we cannot collect to private collection agencies. But generally, when a corporation or a limited liability company goes out of business, they usually don't have any assets that we can pursue. So those are the debts that we're writing off. Is they're companies that they're closed, and there's just nothing that we can get to, no assets that we can get to. I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
Well, as I read this discussion, that you would, by passing this legislation, you would be able to collect 5%.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, that would be an educated guess at how much we thought we could collect from successor corporations or LLCs, where we're able to use the process contained in the bill to assess those amounts due against those new companies. It could be much higher, it might be lower, but just based on our experience with trying to collect from corporations, we assume that it would be fairly low. That's why we used 5%.
Well, I'm having a little trouble with that. If you have the ability to collect from the LLC before they went out of business, and another LLC comes into the business in the same location and so forth, why would that lessen your ability to collect that money by 95%?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, the $5 million that we're writing off currently is the amount that we can't collect. That's the amount that we're unable to collect from LLCs and corporations because they are no longer in business. What we're saying is if we had the power to assess successor businesses, we think we would be able to collect 5% of that $5 million that we're currently writing off.
Let's see if I maybe help on this. What I'm hearing, at least what I think I'm hearing, is that of the companies that actually go out of business, that approximate debt is $5 million in taxes. And then if those individuals, some of those individuals, but not the majority of them, are going to reestablish themselves as a successor business, and that's where you think you might be able to get the 5%, understanding that a good portion of those businesses that go out of business are not going to rematerialize as another new upstart?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Could you give us an idea just about how many companies then would be involved in your estimation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, we looked at the dollar amount of $5 million. Off the top of my head, I cannot give you an actual number of companies that would be, but I'd be happy to go back and check it for you.
I'd be more interested in not the number of companies that created the $5 million liability, but the number of companies that you actually think that you could that reestablish and you could collect from. Thank you.
So if we had like Muggsy and Guido working for you, we may be able to get more than 5%.
Mr. Chair, we hire the best quality people we can, regardless of their names.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Edwards? Thank you very much. And again, it doesn't appear that you can just keep your seat right there. I'm not going to make it up unless someone else wants to come up. It doesn't appear anyone else has signed up to testify on Senate Bill 37. And so I would ask if there's anyone in the audience that would like to have any time to comment on the bill. Not seeing any, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 37. We're going to hold off on that one until we get the additional information, bring it back for a possible work session in the future. And so that would bring us up to Senate Bill 93. I did not have the sign-up sheet. For some reason, Mr. Edwards, I'm thinking you may be joining us.
Mr. Chair, I regret to say I am not.
Oh, gosh. Well, then you can free to leave if you so desire. All right. Thank you. Okay. Instead, it looks like we have Pat. Is it Duvall?
Dolleval.
Excuse me. Please come up. I apologize for the mispronunciation. And I have a... Go ahead and sit down. And we have an administrator who is ready to hit me if I don't let her speak. So please speak early and often.
I'm an extrovert.
He learned his bad habits in the previous committee.
Senate Bill 93 repeals portions of the existing statute relating to the treatment of church associations, organizations, and ministers for the purposes of unemployment insurance.
Thank you for that presentation. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Hello, for the record, my name is Pat Dolleval. I am manager of field operations for the Employment Department Tax Section, and I'm here to provide testimony on Senate Bill 93, which repeals Oregon Revised Statute 657072 and moves some of the definitions contained in that statute to the definitional section of our chapter. Please bear with me, since this is my first appearance in front of a legislative committee. So
don't worry,
somewhat nervous.
Too.
Senate Bill 93 will repeal ORS 657072, which excludes employees of church organizations and ministers from unemployment insurance coverage. It would move the definition of nonprofit employing unit to the definitional section of our chapter, and it would also alphabetize the definition section. The background of the bill is as follows. Federal law allows the state unemployment insurance program to exclude limited classes of workers from UI coverage. Overly broad exclusions may put the Oregon Unemployment Insurance Program at risk of being out of conformity with federal requirements. Nonconformity to federal requirements could create a loss of approximately $100 million per biennium of federal funding and could increase taxes for Oregon employers of approximately $950 million. ORS 657072A and B contain exclusions from UI coverage for church ministers and employees of churches, church schools, or associations. In 1985, the Oregon Supreme Court in Salem College and Academy Incorporated versus Employment Division ruled that employees of all religious schools must be treated equally, regardless of whether or not the school is connected with the church. also ruled that sections of ORS 657072 that limited exclusion to employees for religious schools or associations connected with churches violated the free exercise of religion clause in the Oregon Constitution. In 1989, the Supreme Court in Employment Division versus Rogue Valley Youth for Christ reiterated this prior ruling and held that ORS 657072 violated the free exercise clause of the Oregon Constitution by only excluding employees of religious organizations associated with churches, but not those operating independently. In response to these two cases, the Employment Department covered all employees of religious organizations except ministers and enacted the rule OAR 471-031-090 to define the term minister. In May of 1996, the U.S. Department of Labor informed the Employment Department that our rule was out of conformity with Federal Unemployment Tax Act, or known as FUTA, because it excluded employees other than those connected with churches or church associations. FUTA allows exclusion of employees of employers connected with churches or church associations. Therefore, the Employment Department amended the rule stating that all services performed for religious organizations were covered under the UI program. A 2002 Supreme Court case, Newport Church of the Nazarene versus Gordon R. Hensley and Employment Department, held that ORS 657072 violated the Oregon Constitution free exercise clause by excluding church ministers from UI coverage, but not ministers of other religious organizations. So the provisions of ORS 657072A and B have been held to violate the Oregon Constitution because the statutory language is not broad enough to extend to all religious institutions, irrespective of association with the church, and the statute cannot be broadened to extend the exclusion to employees of all religious associations because it would violate FUTA and place the state out of conformity with federal mandates. The effects of this bill would be to remove an unconstitutional provision. It would eliminate confusion among religious employers and individuals working for such organizations, but it will not alter our current treatment of churches or religious organizations. In addition, it will move the definition of nonprofit employee unit to the definitional section of our chapter and alphabetize the definitional section of the chapter. Other considerations are that the churches and other religious associations that are nonprofit organizations described in Section 501c3 of the U.S. Internal Revenue Code, exempt from income tax under Section 501a, may elect to reimburse the UI Trust Fund for benefits paid rather than pay the quarterly taxes. In 1996, the Employment Department did notify all churches and religious organizations of the requirement to register as an employer and report wages for UI coverage. And currently, there are 3,653 active accounts for religious organization, and of those, 1,716 are taxpaying and 1,937 have elected reimbursing. And that concludes my testimony on Senate Bill 93, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions from... Yes, Senator?
Thank you. Can you give me an example of... This basically expands the exemption to all religious organizations, not just churches.
Actually, it's going the other way. Our original statute allowed the exclusion for religious organizations and churches, but it was deemed... it was unconstitutional because it was different for associations related to it, connected to a church, and those that aren't.
Correct. So they're treated the same now.
They're treated the same now, and everybody that works for those organizations is covered.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, to follow up, I just was wondering if. What would be some examples of religious organizations as opposed to churches? That's a distinction I have not thought about before.
Rogue Valley, Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, Rogue Valley Youth for Christ would be one where it's not actually affiliated with the church, but it's more of a non-denominational organization.
Thank you.
Other questions? So if I understand the bulk of the testimony, we as a state are out of compliance with what the feds say we need to be doing, or we have been, and this is basically going to clean up part of the statute, so we're taking some stuff off the books that may be confusing to the general public?
Mr. Chair, yes, our statute has currently been ruled unconstitutional, and we are actually covering everybody now, which is not what the statute says we should do.
Okay.
But Mr. Chairman, the way I read this is the Oregon Supreme Court, that there's an Oregon constitutional issue as well.
Okay.
So is it just an Oregon constitutional case, or is there also a federal one?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, it is Oregon only.
Okay, thank you very much for that clarification.
Okay, so we're going to be in compliance with the state constitution and the state court telling us how we should be applying this basically across the board, and not having special rules for different segments based on whether they're affiliated with the church or not.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Senator Beyer, you have a little puzzled look. Just want to make sure you got anything else.
I guess curious to know why these court cases are somewhere between 20 years old.
Yeah. I think we're trying to, let's say, get it right this time, where maybe we have been in the process of attempting to do so and, let's say, have not completed that task.
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, that is correct. I was not around when some of these things took place. However, it appears that we are waiting for the Department of Labor to give us some guidance and direction on how we ought to do this. They have not done so. So we're trying to clean up our statute.
And I'm assuming that the department has utilized the legal resources through the Department of Justice to help craft the fix to make sure we're in compliance.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We are currently following the procedures that we were advised to follow through the Attorney General's office.
Okay. I guess lastly, regarding those procedures, do you know whether or not this is based on maybe some review as to what's happening in other states, or just based on the ruling from our Supreme Court and just the interpretation of the Department of Justice?
Mr. Chair, I'm not familiar with anything going on in other states.
Okay. Anything else? And if not, then I'm going to ask if there's anyone else here that would like to give testimony on Senate Bill 93. Not seeing anyone running to the dais, we'll go ahead and close the public.
This is full of preachers.
The public hearing on Senate Bill 93. And I think we're going to go ahead and open up a work session this time on Senate Bill 93.
Chair, move Senate Bill 93 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Right in the middle of the chariot.
I'll take care of that. That is why you volunteered for the last one. We have a motion to move Senate Bill 93 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Not seeing or hearing any. Is anyone opposed to moving this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Again, no one objecting. We'll go ahead and pass it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senate Bill 93 will move in that direction. And I am looking to my left to see if I have a volunteer. And it looks like Senator Burdick is already jumping up at the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Assuming I can borrow Senator Witsit's court case. Thank you.
And that concludes the business that we have currently scheduled for the committee, with the exception of a couple of things.
Which is on my sheet.
Which is on your sheet, which I put over here. And that was probably the thing I wanted to talk about.
Right.
Right. The only thing I had for the committee is there's been some discussion. We are currently scheduled to be in Cottage Grove on Friday during the day on March 11th. What I'm wondering, and would ask you to please consider and check your schedule, is whether we would like to meet instead of on Friday on the 11th, meeting the evening of Thursday the 10th. The reason for that is I think we may actually get more participation from individuals who might have to work during the day and coming into a night meeting. If we do that, we would not meet on the 11th. Instead, we would probably also not meet here in the building. on the afternoon of the 10th, we would use that time as travel time, go down, and if we can make the accommodations and arrangements, meet probably between 7 and 9 or something like that, maybe 6:30 and 9, to allow people that would like to give testimony that would not be able to. A lot of individuals who live in Cottage Grove do not work in the community. A lot of them live there but work in Eugene. And so the travel time for them during the day may be more prohibitive than during the evening. So I'm just going to throw that out for committee members to think about. I'll have Anna check in with you and your staff this next week and see if that's a possibility. We've started making some arrangements for either scenario, either in the evening or on Friday. And we have some, some temporary or preliminary plans, but I wanted to run this past everyone knowing that all of us have different schedules and see if
we all have the same schedule on Thursday afternoon.
Well, yeah, we do. I'm just thinking that that might be a way that we can actually open this up to a little broader perspective and then at the same time allow us to maybe do other legislative work on Friday instead of being away from the Capitol if people like to not do that.
Roger, is that the weekend in Dorchester?
I don't know. Off the top of my head, I don't know.
Could y'all find out if that is? That would probably even work better to
That'd
do it on Thursday
better.
Night.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, it's usually about then.
I was going to say, it's usually the first or second weekend in March.
I think it's the weekend before.
But anyway, we're going to go ahead and go off the record at this point. Thank you very much. And I'd say at this time, if we could just check back, and Anna will check in with you regarding availability for that Thursday evening. And with that, we'll go ahead and adjourn the committee. Thank you.